Today is May the 10th, 2016. I'm Leslie McCartney, and we're in the University of Alaska Fairbanks Library, and I'm honored to be here with Paul McCarthy. Thank you, Paul, very much for coming in and sharing your memories about PLC. And we'll just start off a little bit with a bit of background, where you were born and raised in education, and how you came to be into librarianship.
Yes. Well, I was born and brought up in Rochester, New York. Mm-hmm. Big Kodak town, and went to elementary school at two different schools, St. Bus Sacrament and St. Monica, and then went in the seminary for 4 years, St. Andrew's Seminary, the Roman Catholic Seminary, and decided that I wanted women to be more a part of my life than that vocation permitted, and think it'd be a great education. Then I went to St. John Fisher College. And it took me 5 years to get through, but I had a serious illness and was out for part of a semester and then didn't do well in the finals on that semester. So I changed my major. I went in as a chemistry and then physics major and decided that my background, foundational education, was seriously lacking. This was not a great subject in a seminary. So I changed to history and did really well, and then had a general history graduate or BA, and then a minor in philosophy and theology, and in English. I had a second major in English and then a minor in philosophy and theology. So, you know, I was kind of trying to figure out what I was going to do with the rest of my life, and over at RIT, the Rochester Institute of Technology, they had a testing center. So I went over there and they said, you know, we did multifaceted testing, and I'm trying to remember, you know, vocationally oriented aptitude testing. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, the aptitudes you most clearly identify with are ministers or librarians. And I thought, well, that was quite interesting, and I'd always used the public library a lot, and two or three of my friends, we used the Arnett branch in Rochester an awful lot and read a lot. I mean, would be not unusual for me even now to be reading three or four books simultaneously, some lagging and some going on. And so really a terrific love for reading and the curiosity. So I did apply to Syracuse University, which was, you know, a long stone throw from Rochester, and started there in October of 62.
And this was for a master's in librarian science?
Right, master's in librarianship. And by that time, I'd gotten married to my sweetheart, who was at Nazareth College, which was a mile down the road. They were both were single-sex colleges that time, men's college, St. John Fisher, Nazareth Women's College. It since have intermingled, and I took classes at Nazareth when I was finishing my degree. And so we moved to Syracuse, and Lucy got a job teaching, and I went in to get a interview with Ted Ryberg. He was the associate director at Syracuse, and I was looking for a part-time job. And he said, well, how about a full-time job? And I said, well, I'm supposed to be working on this master's. And he said, well, we could do it, so you've got time during the day. But we have, at that time, they had an extensive evening program, you know, 5 days a week. So I took that up. And the job I had was assistant stack supervisor. And I didn't work in the main library, but I worked in this, American Continental Can Company warehouse that we had taken over, Syracuse had taken over. And the second floor, the third floor was the University of Alaska, or University of Syracuse Press. The second floor was all libraries. And so at that time, it was kind of the overflow and the storage area. So people would select books that had been stored away, and then I would retrieve them, and we'd have somebody come by a couple times a day and take the books. We also were not a receptacle, a better, classier word than that.
Repository?
Repository, right. For the PL 480 books. And this was a program where libraries could enroll in a program and get, and I don't know if it was US AID or somebody, you would purchase languages in, from various countries in various languages. And the forte of Syracuse was India. And so we would have, I don't know how many languages there are, but we would have all the regional publications. They would come, you know, boxes and boxes of it. So we had an incredible collection. And one of the other things at the second floor house was the overflow for the University Archives and Manuscript Division. So I got to know the people in the Manuscript Division. I was alone most of the day, you know. You go out for coffee to a little place across the street or with a young man who was a runner for the university library. We would have coffee. And then the Howard Applegate was the head of the archives and the Manuscript Division, and Jim Owens was the person who was head of the archives itself. And he was a professional. He'd worked with their National Archives Record Center groups. And so there was an opening in the archives. So for the second year I was there, because it was a two-year degree. Second year I was there, I started working in the archives and got really a taste and a love for not only collecting the original materials, but also for meeting people. And, you know, before, when the first thing I had to do was make cold calls to people that they didn't know us, and we broached the possibility of collecting our papers. And some people were just stunned, and others flattered, and others were dumbfounded. So it was, you know, by that time, we didn't get a phone, I think, until I was in the sixth grade, so I wasn't really fluent in, you know, cold calling, and I don't think anybody is usually. So I did that. We did some terrific field trips. We were in New York, and, of course, Marty, I'm trying to think of his name, and Howard were a politer version of a archivist in the West who I will not name, but they would send out like 50 letters a week, you know, soliciting materials nationally. So there was, you know, more than a few leads, and so we would go to New York and we'd just go up and down Manhattan crazy like, and talk with people. And one outstanding person, I think, was just stunned by the fact that we thought he was mortal. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it never crossed his mind that there was a time when he wouldn't be around and his papers might be of use to somebody else. So it was we also did a lot of work with railroads, and I suspect Syracuse has probably a preeminent or the preeminent collection of Eastern and Mid-Atlantic railroads. We went down to Hoboken and spent a week there going through this roundhouse, and we loaded up a carload of records and a full truckload of records, and they went back to the 1870s, 1860s, 1850s, you know, and it was just prime stuff that the railroad, you know, was just a liability at that point. So we retrieved that. That was one of the biggest projects I ever worked on. But we also worked with, I'm trying to think of Senator Flanders of Vermont. And they sent him a note and got a very positive response. And so we went over there, and Senator Flanders was really instrumental in the first Senate opposition to Joe McCarthy. Oh. He was a conservative, but I think a highly principled man, and realized what a dangerous strategy McCarthy was engaging in, and he was one of the first opponents to him. So he was a really, one of the things I really have enjoyed is visiting people like him and getting to know people like him and stuff like that. And we're surprised that he didn't want it to go there, but I think he and the university must have had a feud. Because it was clearly no reservations on his part, you know. So that was one of the other really interesting collections. So Ted Ryberg was going to leave Syracuse, and he was going to take the Director of Libraries position at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And before he left, he asked me if I would ever consider going to Alaska. And I said, sure, anything for, you know, a year or two, a couple of years, you know. And so at the end of that year, in the summer, I got an invitation to join him in Alaska. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a time when it was really hard to get professional staff in, and was a shortage, and you had to recruit hard, and fewer people wanted to go to Alaska.
And what year would this have been then?
It was 64. Okay. 64. Mm-hmm. Graduated in 64, and mm-hmm. we came up in 64. And I was delayed a little bit because my wife had an illness, mm-hmm. and I was like 9 days late. But this was before they would give you, there was any deal to cover travel and stuff like that. So they just paid me for the days that I wasn't there, which helped a lot. And because we had, by that time, two kids, and we were transporting four people to Alaska.
Right, you know? Driving up the Alcan.
No, we flew.
Oh, did you fly?
We sold our car. We got up, and we kind of toughed it out for 2 years without a car. Mm-hmm. And, you know, had to depend on friends to get to the grocery store, and if you had to go to the doctor, you had to pony up with somebody else, and there was no cab service at all that I remember. So, and we lived right off campus at Blaine Lake mm-hmm. Subdivision, which was a lot classier then than it is now. It's pretty seedy and pretty, you know, several of the houses are going into the subsoil. But we had to carry our own water. In the winter, we'd use a sled, in the summer, a cart, or I'd pack mm-hmm. 5 gallons on my back because the water was terrible, just terrible. Mm-hmm. And the early test for water was if you used the water and mixed it with bourbon or alcohol of any kind, did it turn black? And it turned black, let me tell you.
A sure sign that the water was no good.
Oh, it's a sure sign the water was no good. And you look and you think, okay, it's getting fed. Well, it's not getting fed out of Bowling Lake. It's right down through and into the peat bogs.
Right.
So we lived, I came up as the assistant reader services librarian. Mm. And we were in the old building over at Bunnell, mm-hmm. now where IT is. And it was a beautiful building, but the university was forward enough looking to want to build a better library. And so after the first year, Ted got permission to hire an archivist. Mm-hmm. And so I moved into that position, and he sent me out to a seminar at the National Archives, a 2-week program, which was, you know, revolutionary at that time. I mean, there just wasn't.
And there was no archive here at the time.
No, there was no archive.
Just starting right from scratch.
Right from scratch. And so I came back, and, you know, it was like a wonderful new world in it. But I'm glad I had the Syracuse experience mm-hmm. too. So we started up the archival program, and one of our chief assets was we went through the library, because sometimes people put manuscripts in the library collection. And there was a professor named Otto Geist mm-hmm. who was an assiduous collector. Yeah. I mean, assiduous. Some of it really prime stuff, and some of it as base as his own appendix. I mean, Hannah Janot, who is one of our faculty, spouse assistance was startled one day when she opened something and this bottle with his appendix shows up, you know. But he would say everything, you know, subscription letter from Time magazine. Of course, you know, it was there, you know, they weren't blanketing the post office like they do now or the airways like they do now of stuff. And there used to be a series of three warehouses going down the hill where the forestry building is. Mm-hmm. And so we went in there and we found tremendous treasures. We found some of the earliest Alaska Commercial Company records that had been stowed there. The university had been pretty forward, and a gentleman named Herb Hilcher, who later had a public relations firm in Anchorage, was with public relations here, and he had helped arrange a sale of the early Skinner collection, which was this foundation of the Alaska collection. Skinner was an Alaska steamboat executive who funded the collection. The collection was put together by Erskine and Kodiak, mm-hmm. so that was brought up as a basis in the early 50s, but there were other treasures wow. that were deposited, like the letters, their diaries of George Pilcher, who had been on the Lower Yukon for 35 years and kept a daily journal, and some of it is exhaustingly boring, like I chopped wood, because he chopped wood for the steamers.
Oh.
And that's how he made his living, you know, did a little bit of trapping, I think. But curiously, you know, letters or things like that and other journals that we were able to get or had and recovered were interesting for, like, we had a nutritionalist come up and to study what they were eating mm-hmm. to predicate or kind of predictive what illnesses right. might be most they might be most susceptible to. So we put that together. We were the first unit over here in the new building. We moved over the first part of it, and then I was in charge of the move, and physical plant had these huge carts. There's only one or two of these left in the building, I think, these monster carts. And we put books on them, and then we rolled them across the quadrangle, just endless streams, and asked students to volunteer to push carts. And so we got the whole, we moved in, and then there was a problem, and the transformer blew up, and it was like 4 to 6 months before we get a new transformer. They cobbled some stuff together, so there were some entry problems into the new building, but it was a fabulous facility, yeah. and you know, it was temperature controlled, and we were below ground, so that made it a little bit easier. And then the rest of the library moved over. So I was the archivist through the 80s, and then Director Bob Guyman came in, and he reorganized it, so then I became head of the Alaskan Polar Regions. We pulled all of the units together. What else? There was one maybe we didn't. I can't remember.
So what? There would have been the oral history started in 81, mm-hmm. and the film archives were after that, if
right,
I'm not mistaken.
Right.
And the rare books?
They were before, because Elmer Rasmussen had a real love and passion for the library, and he was, I think, on the Regents, I think, till 1966 or 1967, mm-hmm. and he had been, I think it was like 19 years or 18 years, and he had been the chair mm-hmm. for 15 of those years.
Wow.
You know, this is before we re-elect somebody different, or elect somebody
right.
different every few times.
Yeah.
And commitment to the libraries was based on what he felt that the women's collection, the library that the women put together in Skagway, meant to him in terms of allowing him to use materials that he wouldn't otherwise have had, and helped him really foundationally become as successful as he did. I mean, he obviously is a hard worker in that, but he credited the library with making a more than significant change in his perspective and lifestyle. So he has always supported it. And he would call us up sometime. And one time, I'd forgotten who the journal was, but it was, I don't know if they were offering an English, maybe they were offering an English, an old English translation of this thing. And we had the German copy. And so then he asked me about it, and I reported to him, and he said, "Well, Paula, you know, I think we should buy this," you know, and wide-eyed Sisler associate professor, like, "But it's $10,000, you know." And he said, "I know, but we're wanting this library to be the complete, most comprehensive collection. So you buy that, and I'll send you the check." And he was like that. He was like that. He would donate money every year, and then obviously he really loved the place, and he endowed it. So,
right.
So I served as... No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, so he was really the forefather, founding father of the Alaska collection.
Yes,
here.
I think that would be fair to say. Yeah. You know, I mean, there were other people who put parts of it together. But he...
It was his vision.
Yeah, his vision. And he also... paid for the renovation of the public room, the McCarthy room.
McCarthy room, called McCarthy Research Room, yep.
And he was quite interested. And so I had a relationship with him for 10 or 15, 20 years. And it was really real illuminating. Sometimes I would, you know, visit with him for half an hour, and other times we'd go for 2 or 3 hours, you know, talk about like I was doing cultural, how you establish a cultural climate in a corporation, and he had a lot to say on that. It was interesting, and his ethics and his approach to business were just phenomenal. I mean, he was just a really...
And just for the record, so other people listening to this, well, he was a banker.
Yes, he was a banker. Yeah. His father was a banker, but Elmer had the skill and the talent to really grow the bank beyond Skagway area. And he had gotten his master's degree in Harvard, and then had gone with, and then, I'll think of it in a minute, but with one of the really, Arthur Anderson. He had gone with Arthur Anderson, and he had an incredible respect for Arthur Anderson, just incredible respect for him, and talked about his ethics and his relationship to staff and to their families. And so he brought, I think, that back with him, and he was essentially responsible, you know, for directing the bank's expansion all over Alaska. Yeah. And he continued to contribute, and people would talk with him, and he was... And he was honored to have that the Regents decided after he left that to name the library after him. But we thought it was really appropriate.
Right. So it was the Regents' decision to do that.
Yeah.
Oh, very interesting. Yeah.
He was. And then I served as director of the Alaska and Polar Regions collections for 7 years. And it's a great job. It was a fantastic job. You meet all kinds of people. We were going over the accession registers last year, and, you know, there were so many stories that come up, just incredible stories about the people we met and people who gave stuff and things like that. So then Bob Guymon left suddenly, was reassigned, and they asked me if I would serve as the interim director. So I did that for, I don't know if it was 6 months, they put a search on, and I think it was 6 months, and I was one of three candidates, and I was a successful candidate, and so then I became the director. And
director of the library itself, the whole library, right?
The whole library, and Westridge, and our regional campuses, which I think are really important, really important. And served in that capacity for 7 years, I think. Six and a half years, I guess. And it was a real challenge. And at that point in time, in the in the 85, 86 era, there was just a huge, huge crisis at the university, much like now, maybe not as serious as now, but
funding crisis.
Funding because the price of oil dropped to 12 bucks a barrel. You know, and it was like, holy cow. And so there were major changes in the library. And the irony is we had just staffed up to move from a smaller space to a much larger space. And we had to let people, various people go. It was really not a good time, but we survived. And then I think one of the things I feel best about is we had to go through a physical review. Everybody, every dean and director on campus had to present a program of how they would take a 5, 10, 15, and 20% cut, you know.
Right.
And I think we were one of the first presenters, and what I'm really proud of is that the staff really got behind us, and we talked about what we would have to do. And in fact, the guys in graphics and media services had, we got the idea that we would show the library kind of a vertical section. So you could see all the programs. And then we would say, okay, with the first 5%, we would do this. And, you know, at 15%, I said, you know, at this point, you really need to fire me or let me go because you really need a different kind of person to do this. And I think it was a really tough exercise, but I think we did the best or one of the two best presentations. And people really remarked about that. But it was fully staff supported because the people in media helped, and they were on their necks were on.
They were involved in it.
We're involved in it, right? So, and that's at the point where we began this huge switch to digital. That we thought, you know, we could only buy like 5,000 or 4,500 subscriptions physically, but we found that we could do considerably more than that in combines with other universities. We could do like 50,000 or 60,000. So it was a fundamental shift. A lot of faculty were very uncomfortable with it, but we could give them more resources.
This is the online journals.
Yeah, online journals. Yeah. Right. I mean, major, major things.
Yeah, which today is just so common.
Yeah. And then Ted Stevens was very supportive of our going into the internet environment. And we were had two or three grants through the library.
Enhancement.
Oh, I'm trying to think of the foundation and the education department. They were not happy. They become an increasing target of targeted funds or focused funds, and they didn't like that. But we just complimented them for how helpful they were, and we mentioned to Senator Stevens, and they still weren't happy, but at least we tried to be honest with them.
They weren't happy because they didn't think digital was the way to go?
No, they didn't like the Congress mandating awards when they had a kind of a open competition, you know. But Stevens was in a position where,
right. So, as a specialist in the Arctic regions for library collections, did you feel fairly isolated, or did you meet colleagues who were also professionals in Arctic collections at the time?
Well, I had two things. PLC is a critical part of that. But one is I took a sabbatical leave in 71, 72, and this was before really there was much sharing. There was hardly any sharing on the internet of resources. And so I visited repositories that either had outstanding archival collections like university archives to get a better idea of what we might do, or manuscript collections of what they had and how they dealt with it and who they drew from, and you know. And one of the opportunities I had was to go to Scott Polar Research Institute. So I think I spent 2 or 3 weeks there. and worked with Harry King and I think it was Alan, I don't know if it was Alan Cook, was archivist, I'm trying to, or maybe he was a librarian. But anyway, to go through their collections and spend some time and see how they did it and the resources. And this was that, and the printed National Union Catalog manuscript collections was the only thing that, you know, other than a news release that you might or might not see, was the only way to share. And it was really good. And as a result of that, I spent several weeks at the National Archives. We relocated there as a family and worked with Virgil, I'm trying to think of his last name, but he had had the formidable task of trying to get to a hold on all of the Alaska-related records in the National Archive. This is, you know,
that's a daunting task.
Daunting task, and he'd been working for it and for many, several years, and I think it was initiated like in 1967 because of the 100th year anniversary of the purchase of Alaska. And so we were able, I was able to come back, and the Alaska Historical, not the society, but
the
commission was able to get money to publish that. So we actually funded the federal publication of that Howlings of the National Archives. But and then I think where PLC comes along is that I think part of it is that we, you know, you realizing that in working in the Arctic areas, your professional peers in the lower 48 you could look at professionally, but their focus of their materials was quite different. Mm-hmm. And that in Alaska, our relationships were more with Canada, Greenland, Denmark, Finland, and hopefully the Soviet Union at that time. And so I think Ted Ryberg and Nita Cook in Alberta, Nora Corley Murchison, Phil of AINA, and Phil Cronenwet were probably some of the major initiating people who helped push it. And I think Nita Cook might have been really the prime driver.
And where was she located?
She was at University of Alberta.
Okay.
And really nice lady, very professional and very helpful. And so I think they then decided that there would be really a community of interest among these people, and we hope to attract foreign members. And so the first one was, the first meeting of PLC was in Alberta, and I think a real success. You know, it was on campus. We had campus housing and that, and I think the chance to get together with other folks who had a very similar subject interest, and many times very interrelated, you know, like several of the Arctic expeditions either got caught in, the British things got caught in northern Canada or off of Alaska, or like with Cook, you know, he came here, so that we had relationships, closer relationships with somebody like Scott Poehler or National Archives of Canada than we would have, you know, University of Chicago or somebody else. And it was augmented by, at least initially, by INSTAR in Colorado with Martha Andrews, who's really sharp. And I think I had more of the names, but I forgot to bring that sheet with me.
Ron Inouye mentioned Garth Graham.
Garth Graham. Garth Graham. He was the librarian at the in the Whitehorse on the Yukon. And he had, I'm trying to remember his earlier history, but I think he'd been in eastern Canada. But Garth really loved the North, and I think he was excited by this too, because he's, you know, if not the Lone Ranger, the Lone Ranger and two people helping him, you know. And because that was a fairly small community. And then later Dick Engen. I think, you know, at first I think it was primarily focused on the research end and the scholarly end, and but I think others realized and wanted it to be expanded to public libraries. You know, that there were daunting tasks in public libraries.
We have to remember when this started in 71. This is pre-internet. You know, you're in isolated communities, circumpolarly around. And, you know, telephone calls were horribly expensive. So the opportunity to get together once every 2 years must have been a wonderful seeding ground for germination of ideas and practice.
It really was. And didn't we meet annually for a couple of years? I didn't bring that sheet with me, but I thought
I have the first three colloquies, 1971 to 1973.
Yes.
And then it started from biannually. 74 biannually after that, and it sort of oscillates between either Europe and then North America.
Well, that was the agreement.
That was the agreement, was it?
Right, right. The first three, you know, people were so excited. We got to do this again. And then about year three, we realized, you know,
can't afford to.
This is expensive. The excitement is over. Now we got to live together. You know, I mean, you can't go out all the time.
Yeah.
And, but I think it pulled in. It was, I think, an exciting enough development that we started pulling in libraries and archives in Germany. Jean Mallory was an anthropologist in Paris who had his own Arctic collection, and he had been quite active in the Arctic, and surprisingly so, a fairly significant ego, but he was an interesting guy. And he had some really good staff members, and they had collected a lot. And then we found out that there was an Italian Arctic collection. And I think one of the meetings was later in Italy, in Rome.
I believe it was, actually. Yeah. I can look to see which year it was.
Yeah, I think more recent, because I wasn't able to go to that.
Okay, you weren't at that one.
No.
Right.
And, you know, I think it was initially focused on library materials and resources in archives and manuscripts. In the archives and manuscript, people got more involved too, and then researchers who, like John Mallory, were primary movers got involved. And I'm trying to think of, it was Gerhardt, somebody from Germany, it's a name for an individual, Willy Mueller. Was involved. He was a researcher, and there were some real, like Terence Armstrong, who was a researcher at Scott Polar, was really kind of a godfather, you know, really encouraging Harry King and Alan Cook and others too.
Just to go back, the Italy one was 2006.
Okay.
Right. A little slow.
Right. Took a while.
Yeah.
And I think it was, you know, some of those connections in the 80s allowed us to get to know the people from the western part of Russia. And is it the Kolyma Peninsula or Kolyma Peninsula? But anyway, right near Finland, and there was an Academy of Sciences group, and I should have looked at a map, I can't remember, that attended, I think, the meetings in Rovaniemi, because I think the readings in Rovaniemi were the first that we really attracted Russian scholars to and Russian archivists to, mostly scholars, I think. And Finland was looked at more neutral than...
Right, easier to get visas to go there.
Right, and they could drive.
Right.
And so... we gradually got to know them, and there were a couple of outgrowths. One is that we started the Polar Pack Initiative, and to try to, well, part of that was the Russian American Institute in Anchorage was trying to do some work in democratic reinforcing democratic institutions in the former Soviet Union. And they asked me, you know, for a proposal. And so Sharon West and I were working a lot on Polar Pack and trying to encourage people to contribute notations on their holdings so this could be...
So that people would know what holdings were in what they had in these various archives.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Right.
So Polar Pack was an initiative to make it transparent as to what materials were in what archives.
Yeah, because this was before, you know, the easy access and on the internet. I mean, I wrote a book with somebody on the internet or a evaluation instrument for archives, how to evaluate your archives on the internet. But it was, you know, back and forth and back and forth and, you know, it was. It was a miracle at the time, but it would be so much easier now.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And, well, just to get back to your other thing, in terms of telecommunications, when we first moved up here, and that would have been through the early 70s at least, when you called home, it was $3 a minute plus a minimum of 3 minutes. So once you dialed that number, it was $9 when that would be like... $35 now.
So like, you know, calling a colleague in Whitehorse or somewhere else about it was just not in budgets to
do. Not in budget.
So the only way to get out of your isolated little place is to actually go and meet other
archivists
and
absolutely.
And special collection managers.
There's no Facebook or FaceTime
Skyping
and even calling. I mean,
I
think it's hard for some younger people now who think nothing, who have, you know, unlimited calls on their cell phone and are calling all over the country. And
well, at one time, if you wanted to call abroad, you had to phone an operator and make an appointment as to what time you would call in.
Right.
And an enormous cost. So, you know, today it's just so different.
Yeah. So we were able, I submitted a proposal that we would help some of the libraries in the Russian Far East to catalog their holdings and archives, and they would contribute them to us. And so that got involved with, you know, several colleagues on the western or the eastern part of Russia. And then we had invited several of the people to the colloquy in Columbus, Ohio. And I think I had the money to pay for them. I can't remember how we did that. I don't say money was easy to come by, but people were, some of the groups that had money to do the kind of work that we wanted to do were eager to have it done. I mean, it was really great. And so I put together a pre-proposal of 4 pages, and they said, yeah, go ahead, but we want you to make some changes. And we want you to include Magadan, which is a science facility in the eastern part of Russia, an academy site. And so we did the addition, and I said, well, when do you want the proposal? They said, oh, no, you just include Magadan in the paper you've written and change the budget to reflect the cost. We're going to give you that. It was like, whoa.
and through which institution was this? Or?
The Russian. American Russian Center, which was established at UAA.
Right.
Just to do this as a jump off point. And it was all, I think it was large AID money, something like that. So we had, after I retired, we had like 5 or 6 grants to do work in the Russian Far East. So that's after I retired the first time. I worked for 3 years and just did that kind of grant stuff. So we integrated that. But the colloquy provided a place and time for the Russians to come and visit, and they could do that even before the fall. You know, right. I mean, it wasn't easy necessarily, but we were able to fund some of them to come. So the colloquy not only attracted like people. The one problem we ran into with Polar Pack is, at that point, both Scott Polar and the University of Calgary had visions of being able to sell their data on like a subscription basis, mm-hmm. you know, much like OCLC or WLN does, and we didn't think that the audience was large enough for that to make a real difference, but they were scrambling for money and they did that, and you know, we weren't able to get it all together, but we made a significant mm-hmm. and the focus on like some of the Russian stuff was to get some of the gray literature right. that would not otherwise be available.
Right.
So I think I'm trying to think of, you know, it just got more exciting, and I think people just felt that they had like people, like problems, and that cooperation, there was more incentive for cooperation. I think when Dick Engen came up in 67, he had been at Portland, at Oregon State mm-hmm. Library. And his vision in coming here and kind of that evolved rather quickly. I think he said Alaska is a library. That when you put all of our holdings together, there are many libraries outside that have more, you know, because we had like a million, two or three or four, and Anchorage's collection and state libraries, but everybody else was relatively small.
Right.
So I think that idea of cooperation and recognizing that we had way more to gain by being cooperative and sharing than we would be. Yeah, than competition or just, gee, I'm going to stand here and be my gracious, beautiful, wonderful self-collection and the heck with you folks. But I mean, I think a real sharing of materials. Yeah.
What about Jerry Brown's fiscal assistance through the National Science Foundation?
Jerry Brown was a pivotal figure.
He
really was. He was always supportive. In fact, I would say he is one of the godfathers of Polar Pack.
Wow.
He, you know, wanted to get more of the gray literature to, because I think he felt that.
What was his role? What was his?
He was the program officer for
National Science Foundation.
Yeah, but they have a number of program officers.
Right.
But he would attend the meetings. Mm-hmm. He's keenly aware of the historical uses of the materials. He's been a very active in the Glaciological Society. Mm-hmm. And he was just a... he helped us crack NSF because I think mm-hmm. the rest of us were saying, oh my God, you know.
Never going to get that.
Never going to get that because what do they care about
right.
books? And I think he was able to encourage us and perhaps make a case for that because we were pretty successful. And then we were able to get some from National Humanities Foundation and for Polar Pack.
And this is funding to help people come to the various meetings, or this was
no. This was
funding for
Polar Pack.
But
we had we did have money to bring some people to the meetings, and yes, we did.
Okay.
I know the one thing that sticks out in my head a lot is that I was taking them. Russians to supper, and we went to there's kind of a pavilion someplace near where we were in the university, and we picked a restaurant. You know, like Pacific Place in Seattle, where they have the building and there's different restaurants mm-hmm. on all the levels. Yeah, well, we picked this one thing, and it was kind of a medium to higher end sandwich, hamburgers, you know, chicken burgers, mm-hmm. But a nice place. And I said, well, okay, what would you like? Do you want meat or beef, chicken, And they said, oh, chicken. I said, well, okay, now we have 7 entrees. And this is the first time I realized, and I have since realized even myself sometimes, is it is such a, the choices, they were dumbfounded by the choices. Just that it was a problem. It wasn't an opportunity. It was a problem,
right.
Because they had no clue. It's like, you know, and they wanted to do the right thing. And I think it was, and finally he says, Paul, you make the decisions for us. But it's, you know, that was, I think, problems of
cultural learning.
It was a cultural thing that we too often overlook.
Right.
You know? I mean, we have so many choices, and even we sometimes are
too many,
you know.
That's really interesting that the Russian government at the time would have actually allowed them to, in the Polar Pact, make this information even available.
Yeah, it was by the time that was right after
the Cold
fall.
Okay.
Yeah, because we were dealing
with that Glasnost and the more open information.
Yeah, and it probably was more open than it is now.
Right.
I mean, it's like.
But after Glasnost,
it became far more open. Yeah, and. You know, like when we were working in the Russian Far East, we brought money.
Mm.
So that helped. And we brought a fair amount of money, which presented problems to the university.
Did it?
You know, when I...
Take cash and they don't like that, right? And they have to have their
prerequisite
reimbursement forms and they don't understand how different economies work. We still have the same problems today, Paul.
Really, really. Because I, you know, when I asked for cash, $17,000 and they wouldn't, like, what? And I said, well, it's in the grant, and they read the grant, and I said, well, I can have the grant administrator, and there is no banking system, so you can't get it there, and if there was, not much of it would get there, you know? And when we went over there...
Did the money strap to you or something?
It did.
Yeah.
It did. I had pockets. I had shirts that had hidden pockets in it, you know, and I didn't tell anybody in the group how much I had. You know, unless I needed a witness at each place so that they saw me hand it over, the people signed it, and we put some kind of a stamp on it. You know, it didn't make any difference. You know, it could be received as of today, you know, for a periodical. And we were scrupulously honest going in about that. That's what the granting people said, don't try to hide it, because then if you don't spend it all, you'll really be in trouble. Because you're not going to come out with more than you went in. That's, mm-hmm. you know, you go to jail for that. So I think, you know, the PLC has been just a great arena to meet and mix and become more than we were separately.
And then, of course, it's witnessed a phenomenal change. I mean, we kind of touched on this, going from basically no phones and all paper into a digital age and satellite imagery and just the type of information that's now available to everybody.
Yeah, it's amazing. Phenomenal. I mean, it is phenomenal. And I mean, I just marvel that, you know, at least in the commercial arena, you can go up on the internet. Sometimes a book is easier to buy from Amazon than it is to go downtown, because you might not be able to go downtown for 2 days, right? So Amazon will have it there.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a disadvantage. I certainly like to use local vendors, but the but what we found out, and what I found out is in 95, 96, I was on the WLN board, and we lost our CEO suddenly, and they asked me if I'd fill in, you know, and I said, are you out of your mind? I see, I live 1,700 miles from here. And almost everybody else lived in Washington, Oregon, or Idaho, or, you know, not very far. And so I took that position on a temporary basis. And one of the illuminating things is, to me, was that WLN had been really on the ground helping libraries connect to the internet.
And can you just say what WLN
is? Western Library Network. Right. Okay. Western Library Thanks. Network. We were the rival to OCLC, but we two nonprofits had used different models for development. OCLC had tried to capture states by, you know, trying to pull them together. WLN had gone for institutions. And they provided some basic connectivity for these institutions. So we, before my time, there's tremendous loyalty in both, was tremendous loyalty in both camps. But with WLN, there became, as a transition to more and more internet became apparent, the libraries then were getting services from their university and didn't need to go through necessarily WLN. And it's just like you or I, it wasn't, you know, it doesn't cost you any more to buy from Seattle than it does from Florida. You know, I mean, the time and space, the time is the same and the space is indifferent.
Right.
You know what I mean? So you can shop all over, you can buy your bibliographic data from wherever.
And, right.
And but one of the products we did and used was a collection development analysis tool, which was really cool. So
where do you see the future of PLC going and Polar Librarianship? Well,
having not been in it for a while,
right.
you know, it would seem that, you know, that the ability to share is still valued, and part of it is that perhaps people can define their mission more carefully if they have, you know, the ability to depend on somebody else for the margins. You know, it might be my margin, but it's somebody else's, you know.
Well, that's something I want to come back to is, because the archives was brand new and you basically started it, how or who defined what it was that you were going to collect?
We defined it as a history of Alaska, right? You know, this was before Anchorage.
Right.
And
there was no other historical repository.
Well, there was
a state. Right.
And I had written a somewhat critical analysis of the state before Dick got there. It was that the state library was within the Department of Education. The whole state library's budget was a minuscule part of the state Department of Education. I mean, I think it was like 3% or something. I mean, it was because they're supporting schools all over the state, you know, I mean, in Anchorage and Fairbanks and whatever. And that the ability of the state library, especially the archives, to execute a strategy was limited. So, and that involved the state archives too. And then Dick came in, and he was, you know, before I think we were more in competition, and I think Dick was the kind of person that you feel better about yourself when you work with him, and you are more cooperative. And he had a vision, and he didn't take umbrage. And he and I got along, I think, really well. And he had me testify. There was a point when the state legislature was open to reinstituting a state archival program. And Paul Cole, who was the director, and I were kind of team tagged to essentially rewrite the legislation. So we sat down at supper and a couple of beers and worked all night. But Dick was very gracious, and, you know, they wanted it in the Department of Administration, but he said, you know, it has to be a professional archivist, you know, and not a records manager, professional archivist. Huh. So that's why it was for many years.
Huh. Interesting. And then I noticed in the PLC and the what they have on their website, the various colloquies that have mm-hmm. gone on, there's been a few of them all in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, in 76, were you involved in mm-hmm. planning any of those then?
Yeah, 76.
Uh-huh. There's one in 76, and then I thought there was one in Anchorage.
There was one in Anchorage. We, in fact, the one at, let me see. Trying to remember if we had visitors, Russian visitors to that.
There we go. Anchorage was the 16th, and it was in 1996.
I think I remember that.
Mm-hmm.
Probably because I was with WLN at the time.
Okay.
And I think we were still working in the Russian Far East. We worked. We had two or three of the Russian, American Russian Center grants.
Mm-hmm.
Then we had one on, I'm trying to think of the, we had a Soros grant. That was kind of a funny one. I applied for that at the penultimate moment in August. And then in November, I get this email saying, you got the grant. I'm like, what? It's like
money from heaven.
Right, right. It was like, I mean, I was working at home because I had retired, and it was amazing. And we had another one. Oh, I'm trying to think of the organization. It's always known by its initials. Oh, God. Private group. They were really interested in what we wanted to do, and they funded a archival symposium in Vladivostok for us.
Hmm.
So that was really interesting. That was
any memorable actual keynote speakers or speakers that you remember that?
Well, I brought three people with me: David Gracie from Texas, the one in Vladivostok, and assistant archivist down at Juneau. I'm trying to remember John. I have to look it up.
Mm-hmm.
And we invited, we could actually pay for between 13 and 15 people to come. So we invited, we had the people that we were with invite them and tell them what we would cover. And so our party, you know, was going to be like 16 people and 17 people. And it turned out to be well over 25 because it attracted more people. Fortunately, one person couldn't show up, so I could afford to buy them lunch. Otherwise, they wouldn't have eaten. You know, it was like, really?
So successful.
It's, yeah. Well, I mean, one of the sobering things in when we were working on one of the grants is that, and it happened with Russian Far East and with people that visited, is that they, you know, one of the I was stayed with the family, which helped me and really helped the family because we paid him a per diem. And he worked for the Department of Agriculture, I think, and she worked in the science end. And he left for work. They both worked at the same place. He left for work like an hour sooner than she did. And so I'm going with her, and I said, why did he leave so early? Oh, I said, she said he walks to work. You know, it's like 15 below zero. It's not in like, you know, Magadan can be brutal, absolutely brutal. And I said, well, why does he walk to work? Well, she says he hasn't been paid in 5 months, so it doesn't make any difference when he gets there.
Oh, my heavens.
You know, you,
dedication.
Yeah, really. Well, you know, what else would he do with his time? It's like, you know, I mean, I think we are indeed fortunate in the lives that we've been able to live. And you just have to go to some places like that and you think, oh, my God, it's really different. It is really, really different.
Wow. Paul, anything else that you wanted to say about PLC or the future
no,
of
I
Paul
just,
Librarian?
I just, you know, the
it's wonderful.
People who started it were really interested. It was, you know, we were so excited to see one another and find out about what they were doing. And, you know, like you said, it was before, before telephone, ease of telephone communications, and before any significant activity online. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't remember. I think with the Society of American Archivists, we started really using the internet about 1980.
Really, that early?
Yeah, yeah. We brought the first microcomputers to the library and the archives. We had a grant from the state legislature to arrange and describe the Microvell papers, and I thought this is a perfect way to do it. We had worked in a cooperative program with the Library of Congress in the late, probably 67 to 69, on, you know, keyboarding and punch cards, indexes to collections. And the guy who spearheaded it was Frank Burke of the Library of Congress and later of the National Archives. And Frank became a good friend. And what we shared is he had spent 2 years in Alaska part-time as a student, but also as a radio operator at Barrow.
Oh.
So he used to have a place out here in Starvation Gulch.
Uh-huh.
And so he and I hit it off, and we got involved. I think we were one of like five or six institutions way out of our scale.
But way ahead of your time.
Yeah, it was good. It was good. So we had a couple of people that were really interested in, of course, we had the library was an early adapter. I mean, we had a program in the, I think, mid to late 70s of, you know, dumb terminals.
Yep.
And out of the WLAN database, things like that. So.
Right. Well, hopefully this year can attend the PLC.
Yeah, I'd love to. I probably don't know so many people, but they, you know, the founding mothers and the founding fathers were good folks. In fact, I had searched for Phil Cronenwet, and he left Dartmouth. He was a real major figure there. And then he went to a private library archives in Boston. And then he's retired. He runs his own library services consulting. I've thought about calling him up and just saying hi. A blast from the past.
That's right.
I've done it a couple times with people, and at first they're like, whoa, what are you talking? Who?
They're probably still surprised that your 3 year stint in Alaska is you're still here.
Right. I think, yeah, I am surprised. But it's been a great place. This has been, I always felt that you had nobody told you couldn't do something here. If you had the idea, you could get the support, you could fund it.
You could go with it.
And so we did, you know. In fact, one of the more audacious grants we wrote is Ted wrote the body of it, and I wrote the rationale was federal funding for the original building here.
Oh.
And there was a lot of money for graduate facilities. Mm. So we talked about how the collection was gradually, you know, that there was a...
Used for research by graduate students?
Yeah, and there was a... some formula that was developed in the 60s, and apparently we're the first ones to apply it, of how many undergraduate majors there would be, what our book stock should be, and how many graduate support.
Oh.
Yeah, some formula. But that was a rationale that we used, and then we said, okay, this is how it relates to the building, and the archives is a graduate facility, and some other, you know, the studies are graduate facilities.
Yeah.
So, we got, you know, a fair amount of money.
It must have been really fulfilling, too, to see your collection grow over the years and how many researchers worldwide use the collection.
Well, I think that's one of the surprising things, I think, and it probably happens at the other archives, too, and other major research, northern research libraries, is you have people who kind of drop in. You know, sometimes it, now it's well in advance. And Jim Field, I just remembered.
Okay.
This was a note somebody, Susan, I have to stop at her office.
And,
You had a chance to meet some of the people that were really writing Alaska's history and anthropology and political science and science. And we had a chance to host, Jim Michener.
Oh, James Michener?
Yeah,
the
James
author.
Michener.
Mm-hmm. Really?
In fact, I went to his 90th birthday party and we were invited.
Did you really?
Yeah, he...
was he doing his Alaska research?
He was doing his Alaska research. He came, he had an advance team of his wife. Oh. I'm trying to think of what her name was. I would remember that senior moment. And John King, who was kind of his research director or facilitator. They came up and we talked with them. And then he came up and we let him use an office in the archives, and we set up probably 30 interviews with university faculty.
Hmm.
And he had read widely, and he had, I think, a photographic memory.
Hmm.
And he talked with people like geologists, Dale Guthrie in zoology or paleontology, and all kinds of folks, you know, history, but mostly the sciences. And he had a... So he spent 2 weeks here. We had him out to the house twice, and we had the chance that the kids were around the table, you know, four kids. And James Michener, he fell asleep on our couch, and, you know. And he... You know, we talked about editing, you know, and we asked him, you know, this was a loaded question because I already knew the answer, how many times he would edit something. And, you know, well, he did it about 8 times, you know, and most teens think, first edition is golden.
It's right.
Right.
Yeah.
Why would I do it when I'm so good, you know? Redo it. So he gave us some insights.
Very interesting.
Yeah, I was invited to his 90th birthday when I was at WLN, and we went down there. Glad we did, because he didn't make it too much further than that.
Right, but that's amazing that he used the archival
material
for the background of his book.
He really did. I had a great deal of respect for his research methods and how he did it, and he kept records. They had an assistant who would keep records of each character so that you didn't do something untold with a character on page 53 and have to resurrect him on page 422 or something like that, you know.
Good heavens. An operation to...
It really was. I mean, look at his books.
Exactly. Like, they're massive. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I read a lot of Elizabeth George, and you think British American detective writer, and you think this is so complex. I have to keep a notes to myself. how do you have the imagination to do this? And how did he?
Yeah.
You know, like first there was a cloud, you know, and the world was born.
Well, it must have been thrilling to have him use your archives.
It was. You know, it really was. He was here, and there was one time we had like 30 inches of snow, so I had a four-wheel drive vehicle, and we were some of the few people moving around in that snowstorm.
But he made it into the book.
Yeah, he also gave me a lot of insights, but he was invited to go to this over-the-top family Christmas celebration where the family gathers, very extended big family gathers, and the grandma's there, and the riders who are the kids come in on horses over the hillside and down, you know. And I said, Jim, are you really going to go to that? And he says, oh, I wouldn't miss it, Paul. I wouldn't miss it. You know, he was the kind of person who wanted to experience these things, and he didn't discount the experience.
And they probably found the way into a book somewhere.
Yeah, really.
You know,
it's
amazing. Lived experience. Yeah, it's fascinating.
It really is.
So before we close, anything else that you want to
No, I think I talked longer than I thought I would.
Well, thank you very much. It's been fascinating.
Oh, good.
Thank you.